Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Sharif Vakili, investor at Polaris Partners and primary care physician at Stanford. Join Sharif in exploring the extra clinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is psychiatrist, author, entrepreneur, and public health official, Dr. Thomas Insel. Our guest today is a psychiatrist who has been a preeminent leader in mental health. He was the director of the National Institute of Mental Health for 13 years, a special advisor on mental health care to Governor Gavin Newsom, where he was named California's mental health czar. He's also a physician scientist, a Stanford professor, a prolific author, and now an entrepreneur who started Vana Health to help serve patients with severe mental illness. Dr. Thomas Insel, a privilege to have you on the podcast.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for including me. It's a real delight to be here. I love what you're putting together with these podcasts. It's such an important topic.
Tom, I'd like to start the conversation getting your take on a deep frustration I think most students, trainees, and probably most practicing providers in psychiatry encounter, which is this stark recognition that we have clear solutions, often with excellent prognoses in mental illness, but there's this amorphous, complicated, infuriating gap in our ability to get that care to our community. Right? Like, we see what needs to be done, but we just can't get it to our patients. My question is twofold. How do you think about the sources of this gap, and how have you sought to tackle it with your career?
Oh, tough, good place to start, but tough place to start as well. I mean, I think the premise is right that we do have good stuff to offer, but it's kind of like having a really good restaurant with an outstanding menu, yet nobody is signing up to come in to eat. And so while you'll hear a lot about the what they call the supply demand gap, that, oh, they're just, everybody wants therapy and they can't find it. The bigger problem in the mental health space is that some of the people who need it the most are not engaging. And I guess my message would be all of our entrepreneurs, all of our innovators have really been focusing on access. How do we improve access? But the bigger problem, and the reason why I don't think we've been able to bend the curve on morbidity and mortality in mental health, is we're not engaging. We don't really have a way yet to either meet people where they are or to give people what they want. And we have to be clear about this, that in contrast to cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and so many other areas of medicine, where the sicker you are, the more likely you are to seek care and to get care. In this space, it's really the flip side. The sicker you are, the less likely you will be to get into care. Two reasons for that. One is that the diseases themselves get in the way. If you're psychotic, you don't think you're sick. If you're depressed, you're hopeless. So what's the point? If you're anxious, you're avoidant. So you don't really want to do something that could have any kind of risk to it. So that's very different than the rest of medicine. So these illnesses do become barriers to their own treatment, and the more severe they are, the bigger the barrier. There's another piece, which I think is the system that we have, the care system we have, is just not set up to be easy to navigate or to be able to provide people with the kind of support they want. And Sharif will go deeper into this, I think, in this conversation, but the kind of uncomfortable truth here is that the medical model for people with serious mental illness is probably not the right model. It's partly right, but it's not fully what people are looking for. And I think that's the piece that also explains why, even though we have good stuff to offer, nobody's really showing up at the restaurant and ordering the appetizer or the main course.
Yeah, actually, this is a great segue. I wanted to share with the audience a quote you have in your book that has been so eye-opening for me, even as you know, a provider in this space. Is it your book's Healing Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health? And you talk about this exact issue. So just to share with the audience, a way that was really just sort of concretely put this in an example, you talk about Jim O'Connell, who founded Boston Healthcare for the homeless, his experience with serious mental illness. And a quote you have is, "A homeless woman who rejected care for 2.5 years by screaming at the outreach team when they approached was finally committed for involuntary treatment when she was becoming threatening. 3 years later, O'Connell saw her at a board meeting of nonprofit organization. Finding her totally transformed, O'Connell remarked, 'You look fabulous.' Her response, 'Screw you. You left me out there all those years and didn't help.'" I thought this was so remarkable and so interesting, this concept of, like you were just saying, our community who may struggle with serious mental illness as part of their condition, fighting the treatment, or it's like this component of psychosis. If you had to think about the care delivery model that can sort of meet these patients where they're at, what piece do you think we struggle the most at in solving currently today, and how would you change that?
Yeah, so this is really what I wrote the book to try to figure out. And it really was the question you started with, Sharif. It's like, all right, there's so much good stuff to offer. Why are the outcomes so dire? I'm not excited to say this, but I think we have to be realistic that in the United States, healthcare is really a business. And if you want to understand where it succeeds and where it fails, just follow the money. To see where the money goes. What you find in this area where it's failed so miserably is that it's really not healthcare at all. It's just sick care. It's care for people when they're in crisis. It's reactive, it's intensive, it's expensive, and it's totally ineffective. So you're waiting for someone to end up in the emergency room, or you're waiting for them to require hospitalization. And the whole issue here is that we're not thinking about the person's journey and the way in which we engage them early on and more continually to make sure they don't require expensive ER care or hospital care. The model that I've really been promoting, and I have to say, I didn't know any of this until I wrote the book. So if any of your listeners are thinking about problems like this, the best thing to do is like sit down and start writing about it. Because the more you write, the more you think, the more you think, the more questions you ask. And it was really through that process that I ended up with a little encouragement from Governor Newsom, talking to a lot of people, payers, providers, patients, families, spending time in jail, spending time at homeless shelters, really kind of understanding this problem from the ground up, more almost like a journalist rather than a doctor. And it was at that moment that I think I began to realize, yeah, the whole premise, the whole model is not right for what we need. We have to rethink this problem and also rethink the solutions. I came around to saying, yeah, the problem is in fact a medical problem. These people have a brain disorder, but the solutions aren't more clinics, more hospitals, more beds, more doctors, more nurses, more drugs. Yeah, that's part of it. That's certainly a part of it, but it's a tiny piece. The part we really need is what somebody on Skid Row told me in Los Angeles. He said, "You need the three P's." And I said, like, "I don't know what those are. What are you talking about?" He said, it's really easy. It's people, place, and purpose. We really need to think about social support. We need to think about environment, making sure people have the right environment in which to recover. And we have to give people a purpose. And by the way, you know, healthcare system as we know it, it doesn't do any of that stuff, especially helping people find a purpose. That's just not what doctors and nurses are trained to do in medical school. You're taught a lot about medications and maybe the other P of pharmacology, but you're not really taught about social support, about environmental issues like this, not just where you live, but how you live, what you live for, all those things that really matter. So those three P's, people, place, and purpose, became really, for me, the fundamentals for recovery and for a recovery model that looks very different than the medical model. And it turns out that that's actually what people want. That is what they will show up for. They will engage for those things because they speak to what they care about. And to be fair, it's not just people with serious mental illness who care about people, place, and purpose. It's what we all care about. That's what we really thrive for in community, right? That's what we need. But those folks need it in particular. And in, you know, in many countries, they get it through social service, a social safety net that's been built out in Scandinavian countries and in Germany and France. In the United States, we have a different premise. In our country, we think healthcare should provide all of that. So we have a $4.3 trillion healthcare system, 19% of our GDP, and we don't spend any money on those social services, or very little relative to what you would spend in most other developed nations.
Right. We spend like 10% on social services, 20% on healthcare, where it's flipped into those other countries.
That's right. GDP. Yeah, of our GDP. And, you know, that's okay. I mean, it might be okay. It might work, except that's not the DNA of our healthcare system. I was with a group of healthcare payers and providers yesterday, and a big group sitting around the table talking about their pain points and what they live for and what they think about all day. And, you know, they're really trying to make sure they have enough nurses on the OB unit and they have enough doctors to cover the ICU. They're not thinking about housing. They're not thinking about food insecurity for people who are homeless. They don't, that's, as they said to me, you know, that's really, that's not our job. That's not what we do, except America needs them to do that. So part of, and I got to say, I never thought about this before writing this book. I wasn't really where I expected to end up. The book was really about, it was supposed to be about technology. That was in the world of developing tech solutions for chronic disease. I wasn't really thinking about the needs of people who were incarcerated or homeless. But that's where I ended up, because that's really where the story took me. And the final part of the narrative was to say, holy moly, we have to actually redefine what we mean by healthcare. I mean, if that's where the money is, and that's how we're going to spend our investments in the United States, and we're expecting that $4.3 trillion, 19% of our GDP to be in healthcare, then we have to say, oh my goodness, then doctors have to be able to write prescriptions for rent and for food. And oh my, we ought to think about people, place, and purpose as part of what healthcare delivers. And maybe that isn't in a clinic, maybe that's in a clubhouse, or maybe that's not a nurse, maybe that's a coach. You know, we have to really totally rethink the model and rethink the solutions. And the cool thing about this is, one last thought, is that that stuff's not that expensive. Like, that's actually relative to a med-surg emergency room visit, or relative to an ICU day, to build a clubhouse for people with serious mental illness, or to hire a set of coaches to work in the school system or to work in a homeless shelter, that's like pennies against dollars. It's not an expensive thing to do. And yet it saves a ton of money on those other things by reducing emergency room visits and inpatient stays. So it makes a ton of sense economically. It's just that it's not aligned with the DNA of healthcare systems that are all about brick and mortar and intensive care. It's just not what they do. And they have to begin to figure this out. So that's the genesis of Vana Health. Vana Health, my new company, came right out of the book. After I finished the book, I said, well, we've got to go after the three Ps. We need a movement to do the three Ps. And somebody came up to me who was starting a company in this area and said, no, you don't need a movement. You need a fourth P. I said, what's the fourth P? He said, payment. You got to figure out the payment model. So you want to innovate here, you innovate on payment. You think about value-based care. You think about risk-based contracts. You think about showing the payers that they're wasting money by spending so much on a population with such dire results and demonstrating to them that you can get much, much better outcomes at a much lower price point by providing the three Ps. Then you've got a system that's really going to make a difference.
That's beautifully put. I was actually going to ask exactly that question because we encountered this question with Dr. Nzinga Harrison, the chief medical officer of Eleanor, who's been also trying to tackle this problem with the entrepreneurial ecosystem, right? We think about all these tools in our toolkit to try to ultimately help reform and fix healthcare or social care or just serve our patients. And the entrepreneurial ecosystem, at least historically, in many sectors, has provided so much innovation and growth and productivity. And, it's like something like half the market cap of, the S&P 500 is from this, venture-backed entrepreneurial ecosystem that's existed in even like Silicon Valley area in the last several decades. But in healthcare, touch base this with actually Elizabeth Rosenthal, there's this frustrating proclivity where innovations just makes things more expensive every time and not necessarily better. And I guess the question I was wondering around this was, within mental health, where there's such a social component and we're reliant on social systems and you're trying to sort of fill the gaps that our social system is not doing, that our healthcare system is doing, how do you think a startup can make that business model formula work? Where do you see the role of entrepreneurship fitting here? And where do you think some of the shortcomings are? What can't happen without other pieces to this puzzle? I guess it's a question of how strong is this tool, the toolkit that you found in your journey?
Yeah, I guess there are two answers. One answer is to say, let's go after the public health problem where we're spending the most money getting the worst results. And if you're an entrepreneur, that's like, well, that's a perfect storm. You're looking for a place that we spend a lot of money and we get really very little value because entrepreneurs can fix that, right? And over and over again, you see some of the most successful companies are companies that start right there, right at that problem point. And that's what Vaughn is trying to do, right? And what we're saying is, hey, we're not going to innovate on cool technology. This is not about VR. It's not about GPT-3 or 4, or maybe soon 5. what we're really thinking about is how do we innovate on the payment system so we align incentives to get better results? And because we're already spending so much money that clearly there's a business model there, which is the business model is basically to go at risk and to say, we're going to share the savings. We're going to make money by spending less and getting better results. I love that because it can scale it. And it's at the end of the day, it's not about how much money you save. It's about how many people go back to work, how many people finish school, how many people actually recover. So it is, I think, a way as an entrepreneur of really trying to have a public health impact that we have not yet seen in the mental health space from any of the innovation that's happened. The second bucket, which is the one that's been 90% of this story and where everybody else has run off to, is just going after scale. How do we take a problem like the supply demand problem, which is different, really. So I often say, like, right now there's three major faces of the mental health crisis. One of them is youth mental health, one of them is serious mental illness, one of them is substance use disorder. Those are the three big buckets that we have to worry about. What I've been talking about is the serious mental illness and maybe substance use disorder problem, the people who end up incarcerated, homeless, very expensive, high utilizer patients where we get such crappy results. And that's where I'm saying, okay, you go after a recovery model, you build something very different that's really based on creating community, creating, meeting them where they are, building trust, engagement, all of that. That's like one solution set. The other piece is, which is where most entrepreneurs have gone, by most, I mean like 98%, has to do with the really thinking about that supply demand gap in a different way, where in the youth mental health sector, as one example, you've got huge, huge surges in demand, and we just don't have the therapists, we don't have the providers to help them. So figuring out ways, either through better matching, better access, democratizing care, all of that. And there's been a, you know, certainly a gold rush for that kind of approach by entrepreneurs. That's where a lot of the investment from VCs has gone. I'll simply say that I do think it's been successful at increasing access for a lot of people who might not have wanted to go to a therapist or might not have been able to find a therapist. I just don't know that it's increased quality or improved outcomes. I think the data are not there yet to show that doubling the number of people who get therapy or who get medication gives you any sort of impact on morbidity and mortality.
Why do you think that is?
Well, for one thing, I don't think we really have done the studies. What's happened so much of the time fundamentally is that you've taken whatever was going on in brick and mortar and you put it on Zoom. Big deal. I mean, really, that's not innovative and it's not that interesting to me, but it could be helpful. I mean, it does allow people to get more care with more convenience. It has, I think, solved the problem in many companies where instead of having to wait 4 weeks to see somebody, you get to see somebody within 4 hours or the next day. That's great. I think that's really an important problem to solve. The question is, what do they get? I mean, you know, access to crap at the speed of light is not progress. And yeah. And here, you know, one of the things that I'm afraid we have to address is that the workforce that we have is maybe not the workforce that we need. It's not clear that many of the people who are psychotherapists, and maybe even some who are providers for as prescribers, really have the training or the quality that we need for this workforce. This is not a regulated space in the way that much of medicine is more regulated. So it's, you have people who I talk in the book about the difference between evidence-based care and eminence-based care. We got, you know, we do have evidence-based psychotherapies, but more than half of the therapists out there aren't trained to do any of them. What you see is they really are providing eminence-based care. They're providing the kind of treatment they saw when they were in an MSW program, becoming a social worker, or a marriage and family counseling program, where some very charismatic teacher demonstrated something really interesting that, and I saw this, I mean, I had this experience as well. And you think, wow, that is so cool. You know, that they were able to help a family or help a young person with some very interesting kind of intervention. But there's no real evidence to show that that works more broadly. And what you see over and over again are therapists who have a thing that they do, and every person they see, basically because they have a hammer, becomes their nail. So it's really much more based on what therapists like to do, and much less based on what patients actually need. I think in the world of hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular care, that would be almost unthinkable. But it has become, in this area, which is really non-medical, it's become kind of the norm. And we've come to accept that. So I think one of the reasons. And so my complaint here is that we have an opportunity with the shift from brick and mortar to telehealth to begin to actually ask the question, is this the quality we need, or can we raise the bar on quality? Can we make sure that providers are trained to do the things that work? Can we make sure that we have some transparency about what they actually do? And can we get people to start measuring outcomes in a way that is standardized and is meaningful, and using those outcomes to improve quality? This is not like rocket science. I mean, we do this in diabetes every day. We wouldn't think about treating right. people with diabetes without looking at hemoglobin A1C. But if you ask how many providers actually measure anything, you know, even a PHQ-9 or anything that would be important to know whether what they're doing is helpful or not, the number is probably around 20% in the world of mental health. So those are things that need to get fixed. I was hopeful that the telehealth revolution and moving to digital mental health in a big way, which happened during the pandemic and it continues, would be an opportunity. But I still think we're stuck in telehealth 1.0. And that is simply doing whatever people were doing before and now doing it on Zoom. Telehealth 2.0 looks really different. In telehealth 2.0, you take all the data that's coming in through a video visit, the voice, the speech, the face emotion. You collect wearable data about sleep and activity. You begin to collect a lot of objective information that helps you to know, is somebody getting better? Is somebody actually changing? And it's all right there right now. We just neglect it. The tools for doing natural language processing, for capturing all this and analyzing it in real time, providing a dashboard to both the patient and the therapist, it's all right there, but it's not being done yet.
Yeah, we touched upon this actually with David Mu as well, a little bit around the idea of, you said it very interestingly, quick access to crap care. We didn't talk about that exactly, but there's this question of when you go to market, are employers or payers caring about these metrics, or what's guiding them, especially during the COVID renaissance, I guess, in mental health as well. I don't know. You could also say more cynically, just like a influx of speculation capital into mental health too during that time. But I think there's been increased awareness there. Do you find that in your own journey building Vana Health that the people you are selling to understand this metric or care about these metrics?
Sometimes, yeah. It depends on who you talk to. So most of our partners are going to be community behavioral health organizations. Mm-hmm. They're very skeptical of anybody from the private sector that's a for-profit, and even more skeptical of a for-profit from Silicon Valley, where they assume you're arrogant and ignorant at the same time.
Sure.
And sometimes, by the way, that's a very fair assumption.
Sure.
So I don't think there's much interest or appetite in working with the private sector here, just because people assume perverse incentives from coming from the private sector. I'll point out that that's a little bizarre to me, because what we're really talking about with Vana Health and with our work in these Medicaid or indigent populations, we're talking about psychosocial rehabilitation. That's what we do.
It's can you tell you a little bit more about, could you share a little bit more actually about Vana Health's model?
Yeah, so the Vana Health model is to say with the patients who have serious mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar illness, maybe severe depression, patients who have had, they've been the most expensive, multiple hospital visits, multiple ER visits, will go at risk. And what we'll do is, rather than simply providing medical care, we want to make sure that they have access to a coach who comes from their community, who speaks their language, who they can finally trust. We have access to a clubhouse, but to other kinds of pop-up activities where they can really build community with other people in a way that we think will offset the need for the ER visits and the inpatient units and all of that. because these things are not expensive, but they are really effective. It's part of the people, place, and purpose idea. So helping them with housing, helping them with jobs, all of that. And it's really, in a word, it is psychosocial rehabilitation. That's the whole package of what we are interested in. And today that is done in many, many places. Pieces of it are done in a kind of siloed way by community-based nonprofits. My point is that we do something very much like this for chronic renal disease and for orthopedic care. It's called rehab. It's called dialysis.
Right.
It's all this stuff that we do not leave to volunteers and community-based nonprofits that live on charity, right? We expect the healthcare system to pay for that. But we have an interesting double standard that in the world of mental health care, rehabilitation is considered the job of volunteers or nonprofits. I like to say I'm on the board of Fountain House, which is this iconic clubhouse in New York City. It's been around for 75 years. It's helped tens of thousands of people to recover. Currently, we have about 2,000 people with schizophrenia who are getting services from Fountain House and are able to, in many cases, get the housing and get back to work and get all the things they need to recover. And it just kind of blows my mind that in a nation where we're spending $4.3 trillion on healthcare, Fountain House has to hold a bake sale to keep the doors open. I mean, how, that just doesn't seem like the right approach for psychosocial rehabilitation. And so the Vana case, the Vana argument is to say, wait a minute, this isn't really any different than dialysis or than physical therapy. We ought to have this as part of healthcare. And we're going to try to prove that out by demonstrating to payers that they actually should make this investment. They should build clubhouses. They should have coaches. They should support peers. Because if they do that, it's better for their bottom line. Again, it goes back to this point that, you know, there's this exceptional thing in the United States, which is that healthcare is a business. And if you want to innovate for healthcare, you've got to figure out how to save somebody money. And the real challenge for entrepreneurs is how do you do that and yet serve patients and families and get people something of real value?
Are you going fully at risk on day one? This is something actually last week we chatted about with Jeffrey Kang, who's a geriatrician, who was the first chief medical officer of CMS. His entire, you know, there's a similar effort in bringing value-based care and at-risk contracts to the Medicare population. And he sees a lot of startups that try to start a fee-for-service, prove out the model, take on a little bit of risk, and then try to make that chasm over to value-based care afterwards, and you raise a little money and you go that way. And his point is, because his company, WellBe Senior Medical, is private equity backed as a result. He's like, no, you really got to just go day one, fully at risk, and just make sure you can set up your model right. That's really challenging to do many times because you need that critical mass as well. Have you encountered this question at all for yourself in the mental health space?
Yeah, a little bit. And I don't think there's the appetite from private equity to go, you know, kind of with a credit or loan-based approach to do this. But there has been a real interest on the venture side. So, and we felt, actually, in the original conversation, we thought, well, maybe we should be a nonprofit if what we really care about are patient outcomes. But, and this is, I think, important for your listeners, because I have struggled with this for so long, because I've been in both nonprofits and for-profits. And my co-founders convinced me, and I think they're absolutely right, that as a for-profit, we can bring capital, we can bring talent, we can bring tech that nonprofits just don't have the resources to do. That, and it's been so interesting because being on both sides of this, I often tell this story, and I think it's apocryphal. Sharif, I'm not sure if this is really true or not, but it's something someone told me years ago about T.S. Eliot, not the most admirable figure in poetry, but a very wonderful poet who was also a banker. He had two lives, and he worked for a bank in London, very kind of starchy character in that sense. And yet he had this incredible creative life as one of the great poets, maybe the greatest poet of the 20th century. He used to say that when he'd go to lunch with poets, they'd only talk about money. And when he'd go to lunch with bankers, they'd only want to talk about poetry. And that's been my experience, actually, that when I'm on the boards of several nonprofits, and all we focus on is where's the next dollar going to come from? How do we keep the doors open? How do we raise money? That's the whole focus. I just had a board meeting this week with a wonderful nonprofit. The whole day was on money, on raising cash. You know, in the startup world, the for-profit world, you raise the money, you get venture backers, you try to do that early for an A round. And you do that so you don't have to think about money. You make sure you have a runway. And then it's all about product. It's all about services. It's all about how do you have an impact and how do you build something that people love so they'll actually be eventually willing to spend money on it. It's in some ways so paradoxical. And yet it makes sense to me that for us, wanting to serve the Medicaid population, wanting to help in an area where we are spending a lot of money and getting really bad results, it does make sense to be a for-profit. But I'll tell you that the nonprofits we work with just don't understand that. And they are very suspicious because they keep thinking we're just really about return. We're just really about the economics. And yet I just know, because I've been in that world, that's what keeps them up at night is the economics. What keeps us up at night is whether we're really serving people in the way we want to.
That is so interesting. We actually haven't had a chance to really dig into your incredible storied career up to this point. But I guess on this topic, curious, if you reflect back on all the things you've done as a preeminent leader in mental health, what have you seen that you've been able to be a part of as part of your career make you most excited, warms your heart the most, felt the most fulfilling in the roles you've had? And what pieces have you encountered, for example, in this you're giving the example of something within nonprofits have made a frustratingly not been able to have as much of an accelerant around. What have you wished you could change, and any highs and lows that you might reflect on to share lessons with the audience who are looking to, particularly clinical trainees, who are looking to enter the field themselves and think about how they can take their passion and interests in psychiatry and scale that into working on the overall ecosystem?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, I've had a very nonlinear career where I've done, it's actually been four completely separate careers.
Wow.
These were like complete identity changes. And each one of them, the people I interacted with would have had no idea that I'd had the previous career. So, and just to sketch them out very quickly, I started as a psychiatrist, trained at UCSF, and then went to the NIH for a clinical fellowship, or I ran one of the units at the NIMH intramural program. I did that for a little while. I think I wasn't very good at it. I think as a clinician, I loved what I was doing. And I thought in some ways it was the most interesting thing I could be doing. But I was also frustrated that it didn't feel to me, because I was kind of interested in the brain and in science, it didn't feel to me like it was connected to that part of me. I wanted to do something a little more rigorous. So I switched careers, became a neuroscientist, and for over 20 years worked in an area of science, which later became called social neuroscience, though that did not exist in the 1980s when I started. And I worked on oxytocin and vasopressin and social behavior, and did a lot of interesting stuff with mice and rats and voles and monkeys, completely disconnected to the world I had been in clinical work. third opportunity arose when I was asked to serve as a director of the NIMH kind of early in the Bush administration, 2002. God, I had just no experience of public service at that level. And it was a complete shift of my interest in career. I decided to give up my lab and to just go 100% into clinical service. So at this point, I was neither our public service. At this point, I was neither doing clinical work nor scientific work. Then I did that for 13 years, and then I left to go to Google and start in an entirely new career in digital mental health. And that is, I was in both a big company like Verily, which we helped launch in 2015, and then later did a series of startups. And I've done I've been a co-founder now in 4 startups. So it's been absolutely nonlinear. A lot of people have said to me that I must fall up because I keep, failing in something and going on to the next thing. My advice would be, and it's kind of what has drawn me all the way through, is just find something you're really passionate about and interested in and jump, just do it. It never made sense at the time. Every one of my changes felt like starting over, and it was really hard. The hardest was going from being a clinician to being a scientist, which I had no real experience with that. I hadn't done any training. I had to learn on the job, and NIH was the ideal place for that. But each one of them, it's been a hard transition. I mean, to go from being an NIH Institute director, like, Francis Collins or Tony Fauci or any of those people, and then to start at a company like Google, where you've got 16 levels above you, and the software engineers get paid twice as much as you do, and you're not considered very important anymore at all. Or even as a co-founder, where you're in a 1 or 2 pizza company, and you're trying to make sure that you keep the lights on and figuring out how to raise the first $5 million. All that stuff is it's been exciting, but each time it's like starting back at ground zero and working up again. So I've done it partly because I just follow what I've been interested in. And I think the hard thing and the thing to communicate to people is you can't do it all. You've got to make choices. And at each stage, I sort of realized that there was like 3 options. Like, I could continue my clinical practice, do science, have a family, pick 2, right? You can't do all 3. And so, but at each stage, I had to make those choices. And I always chose family plus 1, whatever, whether that was the startup, which is very difficult to do with a family, or our family and NIMH director. But in each case, I gave up something to be able to do the new thing, which I think is really critical, because particularly if you're doing clinical work, for me, either I was going to do that 100% or I wasn't going to do it. It was just, I found it demanding, fascinating, some ways seductive, but not something I wanted to dilute with 30 hours of other activity every week.
That's very interesting. If you were to go back, would you have switched the order of any of these chapters for yourself, or tried one of them earlier and gone deeper?
Yeah.
Or do you think it's timing?
Absolutely. I mean, my wife and I always say we wish we'd had grandchildren first, because that's the best way to run your life. And then you have your children afterwards when you know what you're doing. In my case, it would have been so great to have started at Google.
Interesting.
And then I wouldn't have had no economic concerns throughout the rest of my career. I mean, the issue is that, we were always poor. And when you're in public service, you don't get paid that well. And, when you're an early stage scientist, you're just struggling to get your first grants. You know, it's a hard life. Those were all kind of marginal ways of making it. But, you know, there's no rewriting it. I mean, it's actually been a remarkable journey with phenomenal people and colleagues at every step of it that have been just made this whole journey pretty wonderful. So I don't really have any regrets. I'm not sure I would do it any differently, although it would have been so much better, as with the grandparent comment, you know, to know that it was all going to work out, because right. I never thought it would. You never know when it's always a high risk game when you switch from one path to another. And it would have been so helpful. Just as like, I think the low point for me was, I had been at NIH for a while doing the science that I really loved at a point when the Institute decided it just really wanted to do gene sequencing, which is not what I was working on. And they basically showed me the door. I had to leave after I'd been there for about 15 years, big lab and lots of really significant science. So I had to start over in a new place. And, you know, it just felt at that moment like, wow, I'll never be able to make it. And then to come back 8 years later as the director of the Institute was kind of just, it was one of those kind of completely unpredictable personal journey stories that was at the same time validating, but also empowering. And I think I would say, I mean, to your first question, Sharif, I do think that public service, which is not popular these days, for me was probably the peak of my career, the chance to run, to be at the NIH, which is just absolutely a national treasure, just the most remarkable public agency you can imagine. And to be there in a role that allowed me to help guide an entire field, to say, these are the priorities. We need to be thinking about serious mental illness. We need to be thinking about technology. We need to be asking ourselves, is there any way that the explosion of neuroscience tools and genomic tools can help us? Those were really, gosh, that was just so exciting to be on the vanguard of all of that. I didn't do the work myself, so it's, you know, you're a funder, you're kind of like a, you know, an investor at that point. You are an investor, but it's really, gosh, it's reading everything you can get your hands on, learning everything you can, and then finding out where you have the most traction and putting your money there to make sure that, like in my case, it was, you know, finding very early stage investigators or people who weren't even yet, you know, funded, and helping them to get going in a new area. And just to be able to do that over and over again, you know, the Carl Dicerroths who were just on the edge of quitting altogether, and be able to say, hey, I think you've got an idea here. Let's take a risk. Let's make this happen. That was really, that was probably the most fun I've had through this very long nonlinear journey.
Wow. Wow. It's so humbling. A giant as yourself can encounter those moments in life and chapter where there's uncertainty. And I love the expression. I find it helpful for myself because, and at least, I don't know, now I'm editorializing. Doesn't matter if it's true, but if you sort of carry yourself this way, it can affect your ability to make the right choice. It's just telling yourself it's all going to work out in the end, however you approach it.
Yeah, I think it does. You know, especially as a parent, I always worried that, you know, my kids were going to end up incarcerated for life, or they were just never going to find their way. And they do, and their kids do. And it's just, you know, sometimes you're going to worry no matter what. I think that comes with my DNA, but it's, it is helpful for someone from the future to come back and say to you, it's going to be all right. You know, you can just enjoy this. You don't have to just fret.
Exactly. Exactly. So the last question I'd like to ask, and it's actually a recommendation. We used to ask a different question as the last question, but I really like this one. I'm going to start asking this one to all our guests now. And I'm curious to see moving forward how people answer this differently, which is, what's one thing, reflecting on just the U.S. healthcare system, that gives you hope? And what's one thing that, if you had a magic wand, you wish you could change?
Yeah, I think that for me, hope is in payment reform. It's actually going to value-based models that for mental health, that really begin to focus on outcomes. And my magic wand would be to make those outcomes recovery outcomes, to help us as a field begin to become accountable for helping people to get back to work, to finish college, to have relationships, to create community. The three P's: people, place, and purpose. That's, you know, where my hope and my magic wand goes. But most of all, that fourth P, you have to fix the payment system through this value-based approach to know that that'll actually happen. That's a kind of wonky answer, but
it's beautiful. I love it.
Well, I think it is. It's really asking us to redefine what we mean by healthcare, and to get healthcare, to get beyond symptom relief, to get beyond what I'll call sick care, and to think much more broadly. In the United States, like it or not, that's on our plate. It's on our account. And we haven't yet been accountable for it, but America needs us to step up and do this. And I think we've got the tools. Now we've got to actually take it on.
I have a feeling that our future guests will have some version of this really nice grounding answer. So Dr. Insel, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure, Sharif. Good luck with the podcast.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you have any suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at info@tdio.org.